Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, and welcome to The Political Football, a podcast series from These Football Times. Football is a global phenomenon. People who follow it can fall into an obsessive mindset where victory or defeat for their national or club team can define their lives, attitudes, and understanding of the world around them, both locally and globally. Over time, and in so many places around the world, though, the game's ability to intoxicate and elicit unquestioned devotion to a cause has often been manipulated by states, parties, other political organisations, or indeed individuals seeking a way to persuade, influence, increase power by using football as a political tool. This series looks at examples of such scenarios, considers their context, cause and effect, and how the game has been used by such political forces. And it also questions whether at times football's kickback will provide a means to counter these forces. This is The Political Football, and today we'll be talking about Peru. Many football fans will know only the iconic shirt with a red sash, identified as the hipster international team in a number of World Cups. Today we're going to move past that, though, and delve deeper into the world of Peru, politics and football. I'm Gary Thacker, and in this episode, I'm delighted to be co-hosting with this series with my good friend, Stu Horsfield. How you doing, Stu?
Hey, Gary. Yeah, good, thank you. Again, as always, ready for another school day. Ready to learn, I assume, lots and lots. Ready to trigger some research ideas and, yeah, good to go. Looking forward to this one.
I'm sitting in that desk right next to you as well, buddy. So, who's our guest? Who's our teacher today then, matey?
Yeah, sir. Who's our sir? Today's teacher is Peter Galindo. Peter Galindo is a football writer. An editor for Sportsnet in Canada. He's co-founder of the Peruvian Waltz, which is the only English language website dedicated to Peruvian football. And if everyone just excuse me, I'm going to give you the address for it. It's I've had a look at it today, actually. www.footballdlb.com, but that's FUTBOLDLB.com. So I recommend everyone goes there as well once they've finished listening. Peter's previously contributed or is currently contributing to publications such as These Football Times and the Bleacher Report as well. Hi, Peter, you all right?
Hey, guys. Gary, Stu, appreciate you coming on. I do like the sound of the fact that I could be the teacher today, though. I've always fancied myself a teacher, so looking forward to this.
Well, Stu and myself always say that we learn so much about football in areas and its interwoven aspects with politics across the world that we knew nothing about or very little about. And I think Peru is one of those areas where, you know, as we've all seen the Peruvian sides in the World Cup, but we don't know perhaps a little bit anything of any great detail about the internal workings of Peruvian football. So this is why we say, I mean, Stu and I always say this, it's every day we learn something on this podcast. Don't we, Stu?
Absolutely. There'll be no misbehaviour from us, honestly. And if there seems to be quite a lot of silence, it's probably because we're just sat listening. And so we're not like normal school children. However, we are listening and we are paying attention, trust me.
Okay, oh, man. So can you sort of kick us off, Pete? Give us a bit of a political context about politics and football in Peru.
Yeah, so I think like any other real country in South America, and I guess Latin America in general, politics and football have sort of experienced a rise, a fall, and then a subsequent rise and fall. And it really all depends on the period in which either the rise or the fall is occurring in. And both sides can really be tied to political issues, corruption, bribery, pretty much anything of that sort. And this does involve many aspects of Peruvian society, including the government, and football as well. And it's actually quite interesting because the armed forces, much like in Chile and Argentina and in other countries in South America as well, they do have quite a strong influence in football, maybe more so from the 60s to the 80s when there was rampant terrorism across the country, and also just economic crisis after economic crisis. But even today, there is still some government influence in certain football issues, which I'm sure we're going to get into in a bit.
That sounds like it's right up our political football street.
Government, terrorism, football. I'm right there. I'm right there already.
So, just tell us a little bit about what introduction to yourself. What's your particular interest in Peruvian football?
Well, I am a son of a Peruvian immigrant who moved to Canada. So the fact that I am of Peruvian descent sort of has me tied into all this just automatically. All my dad's family was born and raised in Peru. They still live there. He's the only one who ever really lived abroad. And because there tends to be a lot of corruption in South America in general, and there's such just a wild political history, which I sort of touched on in really every country, coupled with the continent's love and some would maybe even consider it an addiction to football. It just fascinates me how they're both so intertwined with each other, because you always hear, oh, you have to stick to football or stick to sport in general. But I feel like when it comes to South America, you really can't do that because they're both so intertwined together, and you really can't have one without the other, which is so fascinating.
Yeah, that's certainly what we've found over the series of these podcasts that we've done, Stu.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm really sorry, Pian. My role usually in this is to either keep quiet or just ask random questions as people say things and it pops in my head. The first thing, you talk about, you know, being tied, you know, being of Peruvian descent and being tied to it. Were you born in Canada?
I was born in Canada, yes.
Okay, so this pull, this tie, has obviously come from thousands of miles away. But is it, because obviously, but I've personally sort of been born and grown up in, you know, sort of in England, and so, you know, the tie has always been there. But I wonder how that tie to a nation through football translates itself across thousands of miles.
Well, it's funny because, being born in Canada, obviously Canadians are not associated with football. So typically speaking, you will be into ice hockey, you will be into baseball or basketball, whatever it happens to be. But because my dad is Peruvian, that's the only sport he grew up with. And so he basically passed it down to me, much like any parent would to their child anywhere across the world, really. And I just always, I don't know what it is, because the football is not necessarily, I'm mainly talking domestically here, of the highest quality. But I guess the fact that I just watched it enough and I got to know the players and the teams and whatnot, I just kind of latched onto it. And I think what really sort of secured my love for it was when I went to Peru, I believe this was back in 2004, to visit family. The Copa America was actually in Peru that year, and I got to go to a couple of games. And just seeing the atmosphere and watching the national team up close and personal was really what kind of cinched it for me there. And basically to this day, I've kept close tabs on it. I followed the national team with passion and dedication. And then as I moved into journalism, I started to uncover all these ties really to politics and just how everything was so closely knit together. And it just kind of, it always made me wonder, like, okay, is there more to the story here? Or, you know, is there something to do with, you know, something in column A that has to do with column B? And that's kind of what secured my fascination for Peruvian football and also politics as well.
That's brilliant. Brilliant answer. Yeah. Nailed that one.
Can you give us a few examples? Because you mentioned the sort of various aspects involved in Peruvian football, Peter. Could you give us some examples, mate?
Yeah, for sure. So I think the more recent example we can give, and probably the best example, is actually tied to the FFA president, the federation president, I guess maybe now ex-president, Edwin Oviedo. This is a very long, complex story. It almost reads like a new season of Narcos. It's really insane. So bear with me when I go through some of the details here. But essentially, Oviedo, when he got elected as president in 2015, up until, I would maybe say up until about 6 months ago, everything was going swimmingly for him. He hired Ricardo Gareca, a coach who was not even hired by the former president in Manuel Burga, who was actually implicated in the FIFA scandal from 2015. So again, it's kind of following a little pattern here. And so he hired him. He hired the very popular Juan Carlos Oblitas, former Peru international, former coach actually, for the 1998 World Cup qualifying cycle, and basically said, okay, Juan Carlos, you can take all the responsibilities on the sporting side. If you need me to sign off on anything, I will do that, but it's all up to you. He was very hands-off, and that was Oviedo. And everybody thought, wow, you know, like the national team is on a resurgence. They obviously qualified for the World Cup for the first time in 36 years, and there were actually goals for Oviedo to not only be the Federation president, but to also run the country as the actual Peruvian president, because things were going so well. But then we come to find out that Oviedo, when he was owning a sugar, I believe it was a sugar cane company in nearby Chiclayo in northern Peru, we come to find out that he was actually implicated in a murder of a rival businessman. And what is so crazy about this is when that came out, he actually got the help of a corrupt judge on the Supreme Court by the name of Cesar Inostroza, who passed a law that made it illegal for the prosecutors to pursue the case. And it said that in exchange for this favor, Oviedo provided World Cup tickets to Inostroza, allegedly using Federation funds as sort of a thank you for getting me out of this pickle that I'm in. But then he ended up being linked to, I'm talking about Oviedo here, he ended up being linked to a criminal organization known as Los Cuellos Blancos del Puerto, which roughly translates to the white necks or the white collars of the port, which led to him actually being sentenced to 18 months to 2 years in preventative jail while he awaits trial for all these charges laid against him. And I will say as well, though, that Josimar Football, which is a Norwegian website but can be read in English, they actually published a fantastic story outlining the details behind the case in Chiclayo. If you want to check that out, if you just Google Josimar Football, Edwin Oviedo, you will find that story, and it's fascinating to read because, like I said, it honestly looks like a script from the new season of Narcos. It's that insane to me.
Wow. I mean, if you were somebody who wants to give us sort of an example of how politics and football get intertwined, you've just done that there. So, yeah, as you say, it does sound like an episode from Narcos, yeah. Stu?
Yeah, obviously I listened to him, but the part that stopped me in my tracks was a man who did such a good job of running the Peruvian Football Association, they decided he would make a good president for the country. I find it incredible, and it's not to be belittling or demeaning, you know, in any way to, you know, to Peruvian society, but I guess that just shows the esteem and the value that is placed on football in that country, whereby somebody who is seen to be doing well and looking after the fortunes of the football team and the national football team and football in that country could then go on to do an equally good job for the rest of the country. I find incredible.
Yeah, and it's quite remarkable how Peruvians can, because obviously South Americans are very passionate people. Whenever they see something going very, very well, they're at the highest of highs. And then when it all goes wrong, they're at the lowest of lows. And that's why there's a saying that we have in Peru, and it's, you are not Peruvian if you don't suffer. Because we never do things the easy way, at least according to what the lexicon says. So, I mean, Oviedo is just a perfect example of the ultimate rise and fall. And he was also, before the presidency, he was actually the chairman and CEO of local Chiclayan club in the top flight, Juan Aurich. He purchased a majority stake in the club when he was still owning the sugar company in nearby Tumán, which is about, I'd say, 30 minutes south of Chiclayo. And he purchased the majority shares in the club, Juan Aurich, through his company Grupo Oviedo. And basically from 2009 to 2014, when he was in charge of the club, Juan Aurich, who I believe it was maybe for the previous 10 years, had actually gone through massive financial problems. They constantly filed for bankruptcy, went into administration. They would end up being sort of reincarnated as another club, very similar to what happened with Rangers in Scotland, if you want to use more of an example close to home. And so Oviedo purchases the majority stakes in this club as sort of a way to be like, okay, I'm putting my stamp in the community, and you know, I'm one of you. I mean, I'm one of the people. I too love football, when in actuality, Oviedo was not interested, nor did he ever like football. Yet somehow, some way, he actually ends up becoming the president of the federation and running this quite, when you really think about it, it is a small provincial club. They are well known in Peru just because they had been in existence for 100 years. But under Oviedo's leadership, they won their only league title in 2011. They finished as runners-up in 2014. They participated in the Copa Libertadores, which, to those who maybe don't know, is like the South American Champions League. They nearly knocked out River Plate and Mexican club Tigres from the competition. And they twice participated in the Copa Sudamericana, which is the Europa League equivalent in South America. But as to sort of how a provincial club that used to be mired in bankruptcy could accomplish this within a very small amount of time, it could be tied back to Oviedo's extracurricular activities, quote unquote, because among the court documents in the charges against him is a money transfer made by Pablo Arce, which was the financial director of the company that Oviedo owned, the sugar company that Oviedo owned, of $70,000 to a Panamanian account belonging to Juan Aurich's Panamanian striker, Luis Tejada, in 2012, right as he left the club. Now, the reason why this is significant is Tejada, before arriving to Juan Aurich in 2010, was playing for very big clubs in Colombia. And he was about 28 or 29 at the time and was obviously a full Panamanian international and was doing very well for himself. So going from the likes of, say, Millonarios or América de Cali to what is a relatively unknown club in South America in Juan Aurich, when you're in the prime of your career, is quite suspect. So he might have received similar side payments, keeping in mind that this was a player who before this would probably never have been caught dead at a club like Juan Aurich. So you can maybe see Oviedo's influence from, say, what he was doing outside of football, sort of coming into what he was doing within football in Juan Aurich. And then because of the great work that he did in that club, that is what apparently won him the election in what was basically a landslide, because he got about 60 or 70% of the total votes out of, I believe it was 51 votes. He got about 36 of them. And so he basically won over the entire Peruvian footballing pyramid, the entire Peruvian footballing psyche, because of what he did in those 5 years at Juan Aurich, which when you look back on it now does seem very suspect, but at the time was considered a revelation.
Yeah. It's just interesting that you say about a guy who had no interest in football being elected to the president of the Peruvian Football Federation. And some people argue there's a very similar situation with the FA in this country and even in England. But let's move on quickly from that. I just want to take it, you mentioned about the World Cup. There is a World Cup in Russia and Peru qualified for the first time. There was a little bit of a controversy about Paulo Guerrero and stuff there as well.
There was, yes. And again, can also be tied to politics, because so to those who maybe don't remember or don't know what happened to Paolo Guerrero, the all-time top scorer, improving national team history, also the captain, he was hit with a doping ban because he was said to have ingested a major metabolite of cocaine before a World Cup qualifier against Argentina in October of 2017. But the test didn't come back until early November, right before Peru was set to play their intercontinental two-legged playoff against New Zealand for a chance to get into the World Cup. And what ended up happening was he was hit with, I believe it was a year-long ban, and he missed the two-legged playoff. But then that ban, after appeal, was reduced to 6 months. And then eventually, after WADA put in an appeal to say, well, hang on a second, he was still caught with a banned substance in his system, he should be banned for a year, it was eventually reinstated to a year, which meant he was going to miss the World Cup. So in a last-ditch effort to basically allow Guerrero to go to the World Cup and to push this over the line so that he can realize his childhood dream, the current Peruvian president, Martin Vizcarra, who ironically actually succeeded the former president, Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, because he stepped down due to, you guessed it, corruption and money laundering. So Vizcarra comes in, and confidence, as you could imagine, in the Peruvian government was at an all-time low. So because Guerrero, as you could imagine, is a national hero in Peru, Vizcarra sort of probably thought, hang on a second, what better way to boost the confidence of the public than to help out the national hero? So he provided ambassadors, we're talking Swiss ambassadors to Peru, counselors, any judges on the Supreme Court who were willing to help, to essentially allow Guerrero to overturn his pre-World Cup ban, which was actually eventually annulled by the Swiss Supreme Court, which allowed him to go to the World Cup. He was subsequently banned again. He's actually eligible to return this April, right in time for Copa America. But it just goes to show you again how the Peruvian government used football as a propaganda tool to boost the confidence of the public, however artificially it was, and using a beloved figure in Peru to boost their public image. And what better way to do that than with the national hero of Peru?
Absolutely. Yeah. Stu?
I wish my knowledge of South American football was even a tenth of yours, but I know this is not the right attitude to have towards it, but it's almost what's not said that is almost more interesting in these stories that you mentioned earlier. sort of it's alleged, it's implied, although it can't be proved, it's this, and it's those elements which fascinate me about South American football. And we in this country have a holier than thou sort of philosophy to football and the FA and how it's run, and yet in South America, like you say, Peter, it just, football is all consuming, and football, you can almost, the public will forgive anything, if the football team are doing well. And it seems to be whenever Gary and I have done a lot of these now, and it seems to be whenever we come to South America, it's almost there where it's not even a blurred line. There are no lines between mainstream politics and football. It just seems to be that football is just jumped all over by mainstream politicians, or to pick up the mood of a nation, or as a propaganda tool. And it just seems like no other continent, in the world where this happens to such an extent.
Yeah, and what's funny is after that whole ordeal with Guerrero and the World Cup started, guess what? No one cared about the government anymore. No one was complaining. No one was talking about, we still got all, this problem, that problem. What are you going to do to solve it? Is there still corruption in the Peruvian government? No one cared because the World Cup was on. It was the first time in 36 years the national team had qualified. So all the focus was paid on that and only that. And then obviously a storybook ending is kind of nice because Guerrero ends up scoring in the final game against Australia. And it's all a happy ending. And Vizcarra and his entire government are probably just thinking, oh, thank God, finally, we got all these people off our back. They're focused on the football. Let's just go back to business. And you're totally right. I think in South America, people, they're very, very attentive to any sort of fishy behavior, because I think, and I think that this comes with the territory, because when you've been through, even like, let's use an example in Chile, obviously with what happened with the coup down there, and Peru obviously experienced a coup as well, you're going to be very alert to any sort of suspicious behavior. And they do actually, and I will give Peru credit for this, whenever there is corruption within the government or some sort of high-ranking official is involved in it, they do actually put them in jail and do give them their just punishment, which is very admirable. But in the first place, it's still rampant across the country. I think just the difference between, say, in South America compared to, let's say, in Europe or in the U.S. or in Canada, I feel like the people in general are maybe a little, or maybe a little more trusting outside of South America. And on top of that, I also believe that at the same time, South Americans are also very gullible when it comes to, okay, if we tie this to football, everything will be fine. Whereas I feel like in Europe and in North America, it's maybe a bit different in that, well, okay, we still feel the same way regardless, but you can keep going about your business.
Yeah, it's Karl Marx said that religion was the opium of the masses, and I think in South America, it's perhaps football is the opium of the masses. Certainly, when some of the political powers that be in that continent. Just can you tell us a little bit about clubs, and particularly the owners of the clubs, and is there corruption and bribery and that sort of thing going on with the clubs rather than the national team?
Yeah, absolutely. I think most of the so-called fall aspect of Peruvian football still has to do with the domestic league because corruption is still very widespread there and money laundering is still very widespread among Peruvian clubs. The federation's doing their best to try and clean it up, and I think slowly but surely they're getting there, but when you have a cultural problem like this, it's very hard to get over. But in terms of specific examples, the real primary one or recent one that I can think of is there's a club in Huaraz, which is in the Andean region of Peru, called Sport Rosario. They were in the top flight as recently as last year. However, they have owners who are local politicians in Huaraz, and they were running for election when they took over the club. I believe this was about 4 or 5 years ago, but they kept coming up short, and they sort of used football, much like maybe to a lesser degree and for different reasons, like Oviedo as a prop to say, I am one of you, I also care about the community, I love football, I'm the common man, essentially. And Sport Rosario, despite the fact that they were actually playing in a competition, it's hard to explain to those outside of Peru because the competition they were playing in, the Copa Peru, which is, I guess you could call it like the third division and or like the non-league of Peru, it's structured similarly to the FA Cup in that all clubs, amateur, semi-professional, professional, can all compete in this. And essentially what happens is if you win the tournament, you get automatically promoted, no matter how big or small of a club you are, to the first division. And if you come as the runner-up, you get promoted automatically to the second division. The difference is you can actually get relegated to the Copa Peru from the second division. So professional clubs do participate in this competition every year, but you will also have clubs from, say, the Amazon who are maybe just, you know, 11 local, whatever they happen to be, farmers or whoever they, whatever occupation they have, and they're competing against clubs with, say, 100 years of history, and then they kind of whittle their way down from, like, thousands of clubs to obviously maybe only two, and then those two clubs get promoted. So Sport Rosario was involved in this competition. They got automatically promoted to the first division by winning Copa Peru, and then from there they qualify for Copa Sudamericana. They were fighting for the league title. The owners were pumping in a lot of money. They were bringing in very good coaches and players. They were finding players from the local region that ended up turning into mainstays with the Peruvian youth national teams. And whenever, of course, the big clubs like Universitario or Alianza Lima would, say, offload certain players, they would pick them up and bring them into their 11, and they would do well. The problem is, last year, the owners ended up getting elected into local office. And in doing so, they slowly stopped financing the team. The players went unpaid for weeks, if not months. And because of this, a lot of those players ended up leaving to other clubs mid-season. When the transfer window opened up I think it opened up the second week of July. Slowly but surely, all their key players started to leave. And then they were subsequently relegated to the second division for this season. And it could be worse because they're still not really putting that much attention into Sport Rosario, which means that no one wants to go to the club because they figured we're not going to get paid. And I mean, I'm sure I don't have to tell any of the listeners or even you, Gary or Stu, that if you are not getting paid at your job, your motivation is just going to completely wash away. And it's no different with footballers. So the fact that this is happening is really disgraceful. And the fact that the owners were basically only using the club as a tool to help them essentially get elected, because slowly but surely, they ended up stamping their footprint in the region as, oh, they're the Sport Rosario owners and they have a well-run club. And again, it kind of ties to, oh, he runs a football club very well. Maybe he can run the city very well. So they end up voting for him. And then this ends up happening. And now the club's in the second division, mired in financial problems.
Wow. Steve?
Yeah. In that particular scenario, then what part did the Peruvian FA play in this whole, you know, when you, like you say, when you have players unpaid for weeks and months, you know, to me there has to be a responsibility, you know, alongside the governing body to, you know, to try and rectify this situation. How sort of prominent or impotent are the Peruvian FA within Peruvian club football? Like, you know, like you say, there's allegedly corrupt. I would hate for us to be liable on this, but there's allegedly corrupt. Sorry, Gary. allegedly corrupt owners, etc., you know, within these clubs, you know, how much power does the Peruvian FA have to deal with this type of a situation?
Well, they are doing a better job of holding these clubs responsible. So in Sport Rosario's case, or any club's case where they're not paying players or certain debts aren't paid off or certain payments aren't met, they do either fine you a certain amount or they end up docking points. So Sport Rosario, after I believe it was a couple months of not paying their players, were eventually docked 3 points. And then I think it turned into 7 before the end of the season. And then at that point, they were basically relegated. The problem is the Federation wants to be able to essentially take over these clubs, basically get them into administration, and then find rightful owners for them. But because of the way the government is structured, it's a bit difficult to explain. The way the government is structured, you aren't really allowed to do that with a company, even a football club. You can't essentially take them over from nothing and then just put them into administration and then try to find another owner for them. Basically, the owners have to be willing to cede all responsibilities and cede their shares in the club, which you can imagine they probably don't want to do, because in certain cases these clubs are used for money laundering. Certainly in Universitario's case, it's used for money laundering. These very big companies across South America take over the team, they rack up a bunch of debt, they launder money through the club, and then they basically take their money out and run. And then meanwhile the tax man is calling, well, hey, you've got $30 million in unpaid taxes, what's happening here? And the owners are nowhere to be found. That's why Universitario is more than $200 million in debt at the moment, even though this is the most successful club in Peru in terms of trophies won. They are just crippled financially, and it got to a point where last season they were battling relegation because they had literally no money to sign players, and they had a transfer ban posed on them because of what happened to them financially. That's another thing that the Federation tries to do with these clubs, is that they basically prevent them from trying to rack up more debt. So they had a transfer ban, and then basically they managed to get themselves out of it because they subsequently, and I think there was maybe a little bit of bribery involved here, but Universitario basically got that transfer ban removed for the summer window in July and August. They were able to bring in a couple of players. Those players saved them. They finished mid-table, and now this year they were able to sign players again. But you see, the cycle just repeats itself, and this is part of the problem. Melgar, a club in Arequipa in the south of Peru, their former owner used to launder money through the club, and they had financial problems. It wasn't until recently when they were able to clean that all up, pay off the debts through a new owner, and now they are competing for the title every year and playing in Copa Libertadores. Alianza Lima had debts, but this is like the other big club in Peru and Universitario's main rivals. They had about $40 million in unpaid debts to SUNAT, which would essentially be the tax man in Peru. But the owners, again, they were able to come in, make these small payments, make it up, and now they're slowly getting back to even money now, which is good to see. But I mean, as you can sort of tell, it's all convoluted, it's all very political, and it's just one big giant mess.
It's sorry, Gary. You know, when you talk about there, especially when you talk about the case of Rosario and the sort of the point deductions, and like you say, that just creates this downward spiral for a club who are, you know, who maybe the players, the coaches, are, you know, trying to do the very best they can. But when all is said and done, you know, the club belongs to the fans, and they're the ones, aren't they, who suffer from all of this. Either inactivity by the governing body, or, you know, like you say, the money laundering, the abuse of position of power within the club, and it, you know, all these penalties that are imposed upon clubs, and, you know, and transfer bans, point deductions, automatic relegation. Ultimately, the only real victims here, because, you know, players can leave, and obviously the owners are taking their money and running, are the fans who are just left with, you know, a shell of a club.
Exactly. And that's what's really sad about the whole thing. And this is part of the reason why attendance, for the most part, is very low. Because you speak to any just average Peruvian who is a Peruvian football fan, and they'll say, oh yeah, I support this club or that club, but I never go to the games. Well, why not? A, it's for some of the stadiums are a bit inaccessible, which I understand. But B, they said it's all corrupt. And these owners are are completely ruining the club for me, and I just can't be bothered to go and pay my hard-earned money to basically finance their illegal activities and therefore watch my team lose because all these players are leaving. So it really does all tie back to that, and the fact that the fans are really the ones who suffer. I will say, though, that Universitario's fans, when they were in this relegation battle, despite everything that went on and despite the protests against the owners and everything that was going against them, they still managed to sell out about 40 or 50,000 tickets to crucial games to save themselves from relegation. Despite the fact that the stadium is in the middle of nowhere in Lima, fans would trek out and go watch them and support them. So I'm sure that in some cases, certain fan bases are like, well, we got to still stick behind the team because at the end of the day, we love them and we support them. But then on the other hand, you can understand why some fans will just be like, you know what? I can't be bothered with this anymore because the entire thing is just one huge corrupt mess.
Unbelievable. Sorry, Gary.
Well, no, it's great, mate. I mean, I was just sort of thinking as we were going through that, but, you know, the introduction I said about, you know, a lot of people view the hit to World Cup team, and we remember the great players, Chumpitaz, Kubias, and Oblitaz, as you mentioned earlier, Peter. And but it's great to, you know, to have somebody lift the lid and explain what goes on, but the things that most people, probably listening, the most people in outside of South America wouldn't know about Peruvian football. You mentioned about rises and falls in Peruvian football, and obviously one of the rises recently was obviously with the qualification for the World Cup in Russia. But can you give us an example of one of the falls?
I can, yes. So I mentioned off the top some of the stuff that happened with Oviedo. I brought up other certain issues in terms of the government in the 1960s to 80s. I mentioned it actually in a piece for these Football Times. Can a youthful Peru return to the greatness of the 1970s? If you just Google that, you'll see the article, and I go into detail about that. But there was one specific example from that piece, which I might have mentioned, I might have not, but those who are maybe old enough to remember, in 1987, the Alianza Lima air disaster occurred. And what ended up happening was the entire Alianza Lima team, on their way back from a match, they crashed off the coast of Peru in the Pacific Ocean, and everybody perished, unfortunately. And what was really, I mean, and obviously it's tragic that everybody passed away, but what was especially troubling was a lot of these players were seen as the next great stars of Peruvian football because obviously Cubillas and that generation were kind of reaching their mid to late 30s and were slowly starting to retire. So this team in Alianza Lima, they were basically producing the next crop of great Peruvian players, and they all died. Now, what really made this worse was the Peruvian Navy, and I can say this for a fact because my father was actually in the Peruvian Navy at that time, they actually tried to cover up certain facts or details about the crash because the terrorist group, Sendero Luminoso, the Shining Path, frequently battled with the Navy during a very unbalanced time in Peru in the 1970s and especially the 1980s, because the Navy were the ones who sort of wrangled up anybody who stayed out past curfew and basically were the ones who enforced what the government was trying to do. So because of this, they didn't want to give away anything to the terrorist groups who could maybe obviously retaliate and cause havoc across the country. So the Navy were very coy with certain stuff getting released. What kind of aircraft was it? How did it crash? Why wasn't, you know, a rescue team sent out earlier, et cetera, et cetera. It turns out that the plane was actually a Navy plane, and the pilot had very little nighttime flying training. I think he only had about, I want to say about 10 or 12 hours of actual flying at nighttime. He flew too close to the ocean. A wing got clipped, and that's how the plane crashed. And because the Navy was kind of hesitant to send out a massive search party for the bodies, because they figured, oh, the terrorist group is going to react in some way if they find out that this is actually a Navy plane, then, I mean, the family suffered because obviously they were wondering what's going on. Why can't you recover the bodies? Why can't you send out a search party for the plane? Or release any sort of information. And it wasn't really until, I want to say, 20 years ago when all this info finally came out and we finally got the real story. So there's one example of how sort of the armed forces are now tied into Peruvian football and sort of the covering up of very key details in what was a very tragic event.
Okay, Stu?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about politics, you know, obviously with the title of the series, you know, we look at politics and it, you know, and its interaction with football, but I guess, you know, again, this might be my naivety, but, you know, whenever we seem to broach the subject of South America, and we've looked at Brazil, you know, a couple of times we've looked at Argentina, and there always seems to be this military backdrop that is almost like a third spoke, if you like, you know, in the wheels of, or the machinations of the country, and it, you know, and its ability to function, and you know, I suppose again, you know, Peter, you'll know that, you know, in Chile, you know, Pinochet's government, we looked at Argentina, and certainly the 78 World Cup, you know, we've looked at contemporary Brazil, you know, and so obviously even then within Peru, there's also this, not only this political history and association, but there's also a military association tied up with the game as well.
Exactly, yeah. And actually, I think on the topic of the 1978 World Cup, Peru was actually involved in one of the so-called conspiracy theories involving that World Cup, because it was said that apparently the Argentinian and Peruvian military government sort of came to an agreement that, hey, if you give us this, Argentina can beat Peru and get to the World Cup final and win the World Cup on home soil. So there's another example of sort of how that ties in. But yeah, I mean, when you have so many military coups across South America and when they have such a heavy influence, you're obviously going to end up having these things intertwined together.
I remember this is Operation Condor. Was it called Operation Condor, where the military leaders of these various South American countries worked together and to pass on dissidents who'd escaped the clutches of the military in one country, and the Peruvian dictators, now I don't know, agreed to let Argentina win by a sufficient amount of goals to so they could qualify, for providing Argentina passed on some dissidents who'd escaped from Peru. It's something like that. Am I right, Peter? Is that about right?
That is about right, yeah. I mean, the details are a bit foggy for me, but yes, that does sound correct. That is what I remember reading. And yes, there's so many things that Peruvians kind of throw out there and say, well, what was it this, was it that? But I think that's the general theory in terms of what Peruvians believe to have had happen. And now that more facts are being revealed about it, that does seem to be right.
Yeah. Because that was the... Oh, sorry, Gary.
I
was going to say that was the... That was the game, wasn't it, where Argentina, I think, had to win by four clear goals.
Yes.
And it ended up being 6-0. And there was, like you say, there was discussion of credit lines were opened up between Argentina and Peru. There were grain shipments to Peru. And like Gary said, you know, there was this implied handing over of dissidents. And it seems to, you know, that particular incident, I know when we were talking, I think it's Dan we were talking to. You know,
that's right.
And, you know, this collusion has sort of hovered over the you know, the 78, you know, out of everything of the 78 World Cup, it was that Peru game, because I mean that Peru side, Cabillas was such a talented side, and it just capitulated, you know, in front of the world's eyes, if you like, you know, and lost 6-0, and straight away, mm-hmm. you know, questions were asked, and you know, obviously there have been interviews and, you know, subsequent from Peruvian players, and no, it wasn't, and yes, it was, and I suppose again, it's another one of those situations where it's almost transferred into myth, and you wonder whether the truth will ever be sort of known. But unfortunately, South American football, military dictatorships, politics has this reputation now where it's, you tend to believe the bad things rather than the benefit of the doubt, just doesn't seem to exist, and I think that. That particular game, that particular scenario is just another example where you just question what you saw. You know, you just question the result, you question what was behind it, you know, you question everything about it, which takes away the very ethos of football and fair play and all those things. And it, you know, it's such a shame.
Yeah, and I think, I could be wrong on this, but I think I read a stat that the average length of Argentina's shots was about 30 yards. So you have six goals with an average distance of 30 yards. I mean, that's going to ring some alarm bells, I think, quite frankly, because on top of that, Peru, who was super, I mean, I obviously was not alive at this time, but having seen the full matches very recently and obviously hearing stories from family about that 1978 World Cup squad, it was a very strong squad. And obviously that was the golden generation. So for them to go up against Argentina, a team that they were familiar with, to then lose 6-0, it really was a tragic way to end it, because I think when you think back to that 78 World Cup and you think of Peru, you think, yes, fantastic team, great squad, but they lost 6-0 to Argentina. And the fact that there likely was government interference in that result, it really is tragic.
Yeah, I think as well, I think there was some sort of discussion about the Peruvian goalkeeper and his Argentine heritage as well, I think. I think they literally
Quiroga,
went after everybody.
Yes. Ramon Quiroga, yeah.
Yeah, I think some blame was laid at his door as well. You know, I think, obviously, depending on who you believe, who you listen to, and who's, whether it's Argentinians who are arguing about it or Peruvians who are arguing about it, you know, I suppose you can look and point to as many different reasons as you want, but, you know, like you say, it just seems on such a global scale, in such a big game, it's just so open to, not even interpretation, you know, it's just open to debate, you know, for as long as.
I guess in Europe, we tend to sort of look at these things and think it's likely that these sort of contrived results or outcomes are quite likely to happen in South America. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know, and that might be a very Eurocentric view, but from what you've described to us, Peter, about the history in recent times, the events in Peru and how football and politics have been massively linked, I guess it's probably fairly easy to believe. So can you tell us a little bit about how this become established over time? You know, what's the history? How did it occur? Is it financial? Is it nationalistic? Is it political and personal, or a combination of everything?
I think it might be a combination of everything, but again, like in other countries, football was typically played by the upper class or immigrants from Britain who would emigrate to the region. In 1901, working-class Peruvians, actually, they formed their own club, now known as Alianza Lima, and they were founded by workers from the Alianza Racing Horse Stud, which was owned, ironically, by the president of Peru at the time, Augusto B. Leguia, and his dictatorship was eventually overthrown during the Great Depression, and the club remained the People's Club, and this is kind of what has been seen as maybe more so like a rise of the working class in Peru in terms of football and their involvement. But in terms of the wider picture, I mean, as I mentioned, politicians are involved with Peruvian football all the time, as I talked about with the current president of the country. And helping the national hero in Paolo Guerrero, right? I feel like over time, because football slowly became very much a popular sport, not just within the upper class, but across the region, I guess they sort of thought to themselves, hey, look, we also have a right to be able to play a sport that we love. Let's get in there and cause some change. And in the case of what happened with Alianza Lima and their formation, that's a perfect example.
Sure. Stu?
Yeah, like I say, I mean, the history of the game fascinates me in general, you know, the history of the game in this country and other countries. It's always something that I like to sort of, touch on a little bit. And I suppose, I know you are our guest, Peter. I'm fully appreciative of that. But there are just some times when I also wish we could talk to parents and grandparents. We had the when we did the Northern Ireland one, and I can't remember the name of the lad who did it.
Dan,
and he was brilliant. He was absolutely fantastic, and he was talking about his gran, you know, and what she remembered, you know, from football in Northern Ireland. And I suppose I'm quite interested in your parents or grandparents or, you know, or relatives and how they've seen the game develop. And, like, you know, you talk about these rise and falls within Peru and, you know, and how they, what their perspective, what their opinion is of the way the game has progressed in Peru.
Yeah, I think the common opinion from uncles, from my father, from my grandfather, they would say that, typically speaking, a lot of the players in Peru would only come from Lima. because obviously that's the epicenter, that's the capital. A lot of the players, whether it was, you know, let's say they were mestizo or they were of Incan descent or they were Caucasian, it didn't matter about the race, they always came from Lima. Nowadays, they're starting to notice, oh, this player comes from Trujillo, or he comes from Chiclayo, or he comes from, you know, near the Chilean border, or, you know, this is, you know, the son of a Brazilian immigrant, or he's the son of Spanish parents. In the case of Christian Benavente, he has a Peruvian mother but a Spanish father and was born in Spain, but represents Peru internationally. So you're starting to see, and I think this is kind of the case with football everywhere now, is that it is very much becoming international. It's becoming more accessible, and it's not just tied to the one city. I think in the case of Peruvian football, it can still be very Lima-centric, but I think now with the federation putting more of an emphasis on the provinces, that they're actually making more of an effort to say, look, there are also talented players outside of the capital. Let's do our best to integrate them. And slowly but surely, you're actually seeing more players from outside of Lima becoming mainstays, not just in clubs in Lima, but also the youth national teams. You're starting to see half the squads now are composed of players from outside of Lima, which you would never see even 5-6 years ago. And certainly back in the 1970s, when my dad and my uncles were obviously devout followers of Peruvian football back then, watching the Golden Generation, everybody basically came from Lima, apart from Ramon Quiroga, who very strangely was born in Rosario in Argentina, and he was kind of seen as like, oh, that's weird, Argentina representing Peru internationally, all right, well, I guess we'll get behind it. Little did they know what would happen a few years later, but I digress. I guess that's basically the general development of really what's happened compared to when, say, you know, my father and uncles were in their 20s and were going to football matches and watching it passionately compared to now, 30, 40 years later.
Yeah. I just want to touch on, you mentioned earlier about Guerrero. We were talking last week about Egypt, and I guess they were saying about Mo Salah. I know he's ubiquitous across the country as a national hero. And I guess the similar situation with Chiquito Hernandez in Mexico and perhaps Ronaldo in Portugal. Is that a similar situation with Guerrero? And if so, why is he such a national hero?
Yeah, I would say it's very comparable. I think the reason why is it's a variety of reasons. Number one, he's obviously a very talented footballer, which I'm sure comes into account with everybody. But on top of that, he came from a very humble background, obviously very similarly to, like, let's say Carlos Tevez in Argentina. He very much is the common man. And the fact that you see someone like him becoming, you know, a multimillionaire playing football and you know, just loving what he does, and on top of that still being very humble and accommodating to people. Like, even if Guerrero is walking down the street and someone recognizes him and wants a photo, he'll stop and take a photo, he'll talk to the people for a little bit, and then he'll go about his business. So that, I think, not only are they a fan of just the athlete, but also the person and who he is. And he's always represented Peru, no matter how poorly things were going. He always flew back from Germany, mainly played in the Bundesliga, always flew back from Germany and would wear that shirt with pride and give his all. And I think at the end of the day, that's what Peruvian people love most about him.
Fantastic. Steve?
Yeah. I think you know what you've mentioned there. I think that being able to retain the common touch, you know, if you like, you know, plays a massive part in, you know, in the public's perception of a player and, you know, and of a sporting icon or a sporting hero. I suppose just going slightly off that, I'm interested, Peter, in sort of the exportation of Peruvian players. You know, you look at Brazil and, you know, and Argentina, and how, you know, the very best players, you know, as soon as, you know, talent is identified, you know, Europe's ears, if you like, prick up, and, you know, they're sort of swept across to Europe. And I was just wondering what the perception is of Peruvian players. You know, are they happy to play in Peru? Do they seek richer shores across in Europe, or is it a question of going across to Argentina, South America, Uruguay first, and then across to Europe? I'm just interested in the motivations, I suppose, of talented Peruvian players.
I think first and foremost, and I think this has to do a lot with obviously their upbringing, they do want to be secure financially. So whether it's in Brazil or it's in the Middle East or wherever it happens to be, if they can play regularly and make a very nice living, that's first and foremost for them. But I think a lot more young Peruvian players, particularly those coming through the under-20s and the under-17s, they're also now looking at, how can I also improve as a footballer and maybe maximize my career at the same time? So you see a lot more clubs in Mexico, in the United States, and in bigger leagues in South America now heavily scouting the Peruvian domestic leagues for their young players. A lot of them have actually moved to those leagues in recent years and have actually done very well for themselves. And that in turn has raised their level, and it has led to more Peruvians thinking, oh, well, if this player can do it, I can do that as well. So it's kind of opened a door to more exposure for Peruvian players, because playing in Peru, you're not going to get that from European clubs. But if you're playing in Mexico or you're playing in Brazil or you're playing in Argentina, that will probably, your odds of getting noticed go up. And there are certain players now playing for the national team who are kind of in that 21 to 23 year old range who are now being monitored by European clubs as a result, like center back Luis Abram, who plays in Argentina. There have been Italian and English clubs looking at him for the last year. Pedro Aquino, midfielder in Mexico, he has some interest from European clubs. I believe it's in France. So slowly but surely, as they move to these leagues at a bit of a younger age, they're putting themselves in the shop window, and then they get to go up a level and then another level and then eventually raise their game. And that helps the Peruvian national team and the Peruvian game as well, knowing that there is a direct route to get to the very top. Because before, it was very rare for, let's say, a talented Peruvian player like a Guerrero or a Jefferson Farfan or a Claudio Pizarro to kind of go straight from Peru all the way to like a Bayern Munich, because they would have to be truly, truly outstanding players, and they were. But I think now, maybe slightly less talented players like them, or maybe just late bloomers in general, are thinking to themselves, okay, but this can be my alternative path. I don't have to go straight from Peru to a big club in Europe and think I've made it. I can also go this route too.
Okay.
It's interesting that we move on to players. We were talking with a guest a couple of weeks ago about Brazil and Bolsonaro, the new president there, and how some players had come out in support of his candidature for presidency. So in sort of the politics in Peru, so who are the main players there? So I don't mean players. Who are the main people involved in the politics there? So and are players particularly involved? Do they seek to endorse candidates? Do they get involved politically, or do they take a backseat a bit like they do in Britain, I guess?
It's actually very common to what happens in England, actually, yes, that they don't tend to endorse any certain political agenda. They don't reveal their political views. Certainly, if a tragedy occurs, then maybe they'll get behind that in some way. But in terms of actual politics, which I find kind of strange given their, for most players anyways, they're relatively humble upbringings, you would think that they would try to help others and maybe boost the political message. But I feel, though, that like Peruvians, at least players, when they're in the public eye, they are very careful with what they say. They don't want to sort of rock the boat in that way, which I can kind of respect, because you kind of got to listen to all sides in some cases. But given the very unsettling political history, you would think that maybe some players with that attention on them would use that as an opportunity to say, okay, well, here's what's right and here's what's wrong. But generally speaking, no, they do not speak about anything political.
Yeah,
again, you know, listen to you speak, you know, it's absolutely fascinating here. And obviously, following on from Gary's question, I mean, are there, I suppose, what I'm trying to ask here, clubs who have a political affiliation, you know, right-wing clubs, left-wing clubs, where, you know, maybe the majority of the supporters are well-known for supporting a certain political stance, or is it very neutral within Peru? Because from what you're saying to me, you know, Peruvian fans of football seem to be very just, you know, we'll take what comes, we love the game, and, you know, as long as the game is happening in the right way, we're happy. But I was just wondering whether any of the clubs are, you know, not notorious, that's the wrong word, but known for their political standpoint.
Strangely, no, actually. In terms of the Barras Bravas, like the Ultras,
yeah,
none of them are very, very left wing, very right wing. They're actually very center in a lot of ways. Like you'll have some that maybe have different political views, and you'll certainly have some who maybe engage in criminal activities. But generally speaking, no, they don't really associate themselves with a certain side of the spectrum, which I do find interesting because you see it almost everywhere else, but in Peru, that's not really an issue. It's just more so of, do you support this club? Well, then, okay, let's all get behind them, sort of thing.
It's funny because, I mean, before I even asked the question, I kind of guessed that purely by the way you speak and obviously your vast amount of knowledge and certainly what's come across today, you know, that's kind of the answer I was expecting, to be honest, from what you've said. And I just sort of wanted to check that the way I was interpreting what you were saying is, you know, is actually how it is, and it is. Thanks.
Not a problem.
can I ask, obviously a lot of corruption, you mentioned bribery, is detrimental to football, but are there any elements of the political influences in Peru that are beneficial to the game? And does the game impact back on the political situation? So does football help to mitigate the bad things that are going on in Peruvian politics?
I would say slowly but surely, yes. As I mentioned, the Federation is trying to push through certain laws that would allow them to take clubs into administration and essentially help them out and to build them back up again, much like what happened with Rangers, as I spoke about earlier. But the problem is that the government, they really do treat football as a separate entity. There's actually a law right now that's trying to be passed that would essentially try to get the government more involved in Peruvian football, which depends on the passing of a law. However, FIFA, because of their objection to interference in a federation, they are threatening to suspend the Peruvian Federation if it passes. The key details, there was an article on Fox Sports, if you just Google FIFA threatens to suspend Peru if law is changed. There's also a very good podcast with one of my colleagues from the Peruvian Waltz, Christopher Viscardo. He was on Beyond the Pitch with Juan Arango and spoke about this issue in depth. So if you're more interested to know about that, you can check out that podcast, read that article. If you just Google Christopher Viscardo, Beyond the Pitch, that will pop up in one of the top three or four suggestions in Google. You can give that a listen, and it's actually very insightful and very informative.
Excellent. Thank you for that. Stu?
Yeah, like I say, I mean, obviously your knowledge and your... It's incredible, you know. And again, you know, I could listen to you all night. You know, there's so many questions, so many things that you bring up or that you mentioned almost merely in passing, and it's like, oh my god, I need to think about that. I need to look at that. I need to ask about that. I need to do that. And I'm just wondering. I'll talk about the history and how much, you know, I love the history of the game, but I suppose also, you know, you've got to look to the future and, you know, and the future of the Peruvian game, and, you know, and I suppose it's a difficult question to ask. I appreciate that. But how do you see the Peruvian game developing, progressing? You know, does it need something? Is something already happening? Is it in place? Or is it, you know, in a poor state, in a poor situation for the foreseeable future? I'm just interested in how you see it.
Yeah, I think eventually it always reaches some kind of conclusion, whether good or bad. I don't know if that'll be the case here because, like anyone in South America, Peruvians are mad for football. If politicians feel that they can use the sport to appeal to the citizens, they will do it. And they will buy it every single time, talking about the common man. Peru is, I mean, as I mentioned, very good about trying to fix the issues. The problem is that they're like weeds. You pick them and then they just grow right back, and then you got to pick them all over again and try to rid them completely. So maybe if the issue becomes so widespread, it could lead to repercussions that ceases it entirely. But I mean, I don't really see it kind of reaching that inevitable and proper conclusion, really.
So it's just an open-ended story, isn't it, that we just need to follow?
Pretty much. Brilliant. Exactly, yeah. Stay tuned.
I will now.
But this has been a fascinating discussion, as they always are on the political football, and, you know, times are always our enemy on this, and we've run a little bit over, but frankly, you know, as they said in Gone with the Wind, who gives a damn? So is that quote? Frankly, scholars, I don't give a damn, yeah. I should say. Anyway, we always have the same closing question, Pete, so I want to ask this to you. And sometimes I get encouraging answers, and other times less so, but I guess that sort of reflects different kind of parts of the world we've been discussing. So here we go. So can football exist in a political vacuum? Or does the passion engendered by the game too easily lend itself to being a political tool? In short, is the political football inevitable in Peru?
I think so, yeah. I think football is very much a tool for anybody to use, not just politics. I mean, we see it with, if you want to use a wider example, TV networks. I mean, in Peru, the TV network there, Gol Peru, they have a monopoly on the domestic rights. It's them and them only. The national team rights only go to one company. One radio station is only allowed to cover or to essentially broadcast the games. I guess it's the same anywhere else, but it's almost like no one else even tries to steal the rights away. And we also see it with sponsors too. I mean, if you want to use Gazprom as an example, even the organizing bodies within Peru as well. Politicians, I feel, are just another group of people who use it as a pawn. And that is the case in Peru and everywhere else. But I think people react to it more than other entities because politics is always so divisive. So if you mix football with it, which can also be very divisive, it almost leads to a spontaneous combustion.
Fantastic answer, Pete. brilliant. just a couple of quick closing thoughts. I was saying I was doing a podcast tonight, and my wife says to me, because I said, what are you doing? I said, Peru. She said, oh, what does that, is it affected by the altitude? And you mentioned about the Copa Libertadores being played there. Not another Copa Libertadores, the Copa America being played there. Is the altitude a big issue there?
It depends on the city. Like, if you go to Cusco, absolutely it is. You will always see teams within 20, 30 minutes just running out of gas. I mean, when I go there, and I'm not used to the altitude, when I've gone to Cusco, just walking around for 15 minutes, I am knackered. So imagine running around in that for 25 or 30 minutes when you're not necessarily used to playing that high up. Copa America, it wasn't an issue because they tended to stay along the coast so that everybody had a fair advantage, which is very rare in South America. Giving teams a fair advantage. But in terms of whether it affects teams going there, absolutely it does. If you go to like Arequipa, it's generally manageable, but the further east you go, which obviously means that you go higher up, it does get a lot worse. And in Copa Libertadores especially, whether it's Real Garcilaso, the club from Chiclayo, or from Cusco, excuse me, you will see teams go there and inevitably not win because the altitude is just too much for them to handle.
Yeah, sure. One final thing you mentioned about your location in Canada and there's not much football going on there. And today I submitted an article to these Football Times looking at Tony Waiters and the Vancouver Whitecaps when they won the Soccer Bowl. So I just thought I'd mention, because it's quite interesting when you mentioned about Canada and football. It's just an intriguing story that I found. So any late thoughts, Dave?
Like I say, all of these, every time we have a guest, I'm like, oh, they've been the best ones so far, which I feel really bad now, actually, sort of confessing, because the last one I'll now be sat there thinking, oh, nice one, thanks. And the person who went first in the very first episode, I'll be like, oh, well, that's great. But every single time, it just never fails. These never fail to deliver, ever. And that's purely down to the guest that we have on. You know, like I say, Peter, I mean, I knew bits about Peruvian football in terms of 78, playing at altitude, a couple of the players. I was just coming into it as a blank canvas, and it has just been, like I say, just fascinating, as it always is, but I've learned so much. And again, I've got so much to go away and look at and read about and research and listen to, which is kind of why I tag along with these with Gary. So whoever's trying to shake me off, I don't know, but I'm just happy to tag along because they're just brilliant. And you know, you've been absolutely sensational today.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that. And that's why we started the website on Peruvian football, because they've kind of been sort of off to the side for so long, the general football fan, sure, they'll recognize some names. They'll see the iconic shirt with the sash across it, and they'll think, oh, yeah, you know, I love Peru. It's a great shirt, you know, great players, Guias and Chupitas and the like. But with this recent resurgence, we thought, hey, why don't we capitalize on this and provide it to more people? Because obviously, covering it in English will encapsulate more fans across the world. So, I mean, anytime I get an opportunity to be able to talk about Peruvian football, I embrace it. And I'm glad that you both enjoyed it. Hopefully the listeners do as well.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. I have no doubt.
Yeah, I can only echo what Stu said. And I follow the Peruvian Wolves on Twitter as well. And it's a really good Twitter feed. And for anybody who's listening, I'll just emphasize again the address for the website, which is football, that's FUTBOLDLB, all lowercase, no spaces, no hyphens, .com. That's FUTBOLDLB.com. Have a look at that website, and you'll see more about Peruvian football. A fascinating subject. It's massive thanks to Peter for coming on and talking with us tonight about Peru. So that's been the Political Football, looking at Peru and the politics and the game in that country. Catch us next time on the next episode of the Political Football, and we'll explore somewhere else and another subject where politics and football are intertwined. Thank you. Good night.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.